Everyone, welcome to The Final Four is Not on the Schedule. I'm your host, Eric, alongside with expert analyst, Rod. Thanks for joining us on the best MSU basketball podcast featuring an in-depth recruiting, game matchup, and post-game analysis. We dive deep to give you the best tools to enjoy the Spartans and impress your friends and family. Hey, everybody, it's Eric alongside Rod, and here to celebrate our narrow 78-77 victory over the University of Portland in the fifth place game of the Phil Knight Invitational, PK85. Before we start, I just want to remind you that we still have a week to go for picks to win the free t-shirt, the t-shirt contest. So if you want to make your predictions for the Big Ten standings 1 through 14, send those to me at eric@tffinots.com. Make sure you obviously leave your name and then also the amount of points Michigan State scores against Michigan this season as a tiebreaker. Well, Rod, I think one thing we can rest assured at least early in the season is that if you have a coronary condition, you have been stress tested and you should feel comfortable because you have had this is like our third straight almost near loss as we get near the end of the season or the beginning of the season still. I don't know what to say except, you know, I could kind of feel this one coming, but then, you know, would Joey miss that three that would have made it 15, that would have made it sort of a laugher, you know, then kind of the wheels came off and I don't know. I mean, I guess to just let you riff a little bit because this is one of those games where, I mean, yes, you're glad they win. A month from now, we're not going to remember any of this about this game. I mean, you might remember it, but you're not going to, like, it doesn't matter that you win by one or win by 10, except that it is this a sign of, you know, who this team really is, or is this, I don't know. I mean, I in some ways, I feel like that last possession, it could easily have been a foul called.
I'm not prepared to say that because they are missing two big components. And
sure,
for as much as it means on the offensive end, I've now sort of concluded, and this isn't this isn't any great revelation, but I think it's impacting them more defensively. Now, yeah, they found some answers for that, which we'll get to. Jason Whitens, but still in that kind of freak out in the last minute 10, I would feel much more comfortable with Malik Hall and Jaden Akins on that court, or one of them at least. If only because I would feel they'd have a better chance of actually locating shooters. You know, they did such a fantastic job for 19 minutes, or we'll say 18 minutes and 50 seconds, in terms of really clamping down, not just Portland's accuracy, but even the attempts they got. We talk about that all the time. The best thing you can do in defending the three is don't let the opponent get those shots off. And Michigan State really stepped it up after a pretty miserable first half in that department and just locked them down. And then just in part, I think because the turnovers were leading to scramble situations, just forgot to cover anybody. I mean, it was awful. Those threes that they hit were wide open threes. I mean, the last one, I guess you give Mahdi a little credit for getting out there and contesting it, but that's solely due to his length and athletic ability. The fact is he wasn't in good guarding position, and you saw it on the replay. Robbie Hummel mentioned it, which, by the way, just as an aside, I like Robbie Hummel as an analyst anyway, but I've never been so thankful in my life to have Robbie Hummel doing a broadcast after the last two games. But that said, so even there on that one where it was semi-contested, it shouldn't have ever been a clean look at all, even a halfway clean look, because he was so far out of position, didn't realize who he was guarding, as Hummel correctly noted. You know, in that situation, why are you ever in the paint? You know?
Right. I mean, yeah, right. No, yeah. When you're down. Yeah.
Up yeah. Four, yeah. You know what they're going to do. You have to be on the perimeter, you know, and that's a team that obviously, as we saw throughout a good portion of this game, pretty much everybody is a threat, you know? So, look, I'll start with the good. If you told any Michigan State fan, and I mean any, that after the first seven games of this schedule, Michigan State would be sitting there at 5-2, they'd have taken it and run. And if you say you wouldn't, you're lying.
Yeah.
That is a bottom line truth here. But the way they are finishing games, this is the last three wins have been in this department. It really is concerning. And it's mostly, everybody deserves a share of the blame. You know, Joey Hauser deserves some blame. I've seen him take a lot of criticism on social media before tonight and also after this game. But the primary burden is AJ Hogarth. That's just simple, period. I personally can't accept any other answer. That is your point guard. That is your floor leader. And he made, of those three turnovers late, he made two of them. And the third, the one that might get charged to Hauser, I'm not sure, on the inbound pass, I put halfway on AJ too, because he didn't come hard to the ball.
Yeah.
So you, and he is easily, for me, the most frustrating player in recent memory at Michigan State, maybe ever for me, maybe ever, because I tend to be on the more optimistic, forgiving side of the slate. I'm pretty slow to start really coming at guys. And I'll admit, I was not a believer in AJ Hogarth when they recruited him, nor was I during his freshman year. Last year, he certainly proved me and many other people wrong by showing that he was at least capable of being a productive player and maybe even something more than that. And when he's at his best, as he was for the first, say, 18 minutes and 50 seconds of that second half, after a pretty miserable first half, to be honest, you see how he can elevate this team, because he just did everything right. I mean, great passes, was under control, went to really what is his one great offensive strength, which is getting the ball to the rim and finishing. And he did it repeatedly. And then he played much better defense than we've seen lately. You know, that's one of the really discouraging things to me about him this year. You can talk about the turnovers, but to me, it's that a guy that I know full well is capable of being a really good defensive player has only been spottily that at best. Yet through most of that second half, he was, you know? So that's where I start. You can say it's a team thing, and I don't disagree. Other guys have to step up as well. Maybe they should rethink Joey as the inbound guy. I don't know. The problem is I don't know who else is a candidate for it, because you want both of Tyson and AJ available to receive a pass, right? Because they're your guards. They're the guys you want with the ball in their hands against pressure. So it's kind of a tough spot. Michigan State traditionally has used a guy like Joey with some size to be the inbound guy, but maybe they look at that. I don't know, but to me, it really starts with AJ Hogarth, because at his best, this is a guy who can be as good as any point guard in the Big Ten, and the Big Ten isn't loaded with great point guards right now, but he can be as good as anybody in the league in that area, in my opinion, as an all around player. But we have only intermittently at best seen that so far this season. Yeah. So something's got to change there. That's where it starts. And unlike the Oregon game where, you know, I remember mentioning, hey, the one thing you could take solace for is, yeah, Michigan State let them hang around, but they did hit six big free throws late to put that one away. Okay. So there was something that they did proactively to get that win, even though it wasn't great late game play. This one, there was nothing. The last bucket they got was with, I think it was a minute 10 to go. Tyson Walker on a great take and finish puts him up 9 with a minute 10 to play. That should be it. Under any circumstances, any situation, I don't care if you're playing the Golden State Warriors, ball game.
Yeah.
And it wasn't ball game because of the mistakes that were made and that we've continued to see. They've still unfortunately got some more basketball games to get through. And I'm trying to think of how the schedule goes. You've definitely got Notre Dame, Penn State, Northwestern. And I think maybe Brown. Is it Brown Oakland, and Oakland Brown and before the break?
And Buffalo.
Brown and Buffalo.
Oh, do you mean before the Big Ten starts or before?
No, before break? They have a 9-day break around the holiday. I'm talking about what's between them and that.
There's Brown on the 10th, And then Oakland on the 21st.
Okay. So it's Brown. It's four more games, right? Notre Dame, the two Big Ten games, Brown.
Yep.
Okay. So four more games they got to get through. But I really feel like for this specific area, and I'm going to be very interested. We're recording this essentially right after the game, so we don't know yet what Tom Izzo's had to say, but I have to believe
that's why Rod's so hot.
I have to believe he's going to speak to this. They've got to get it fixed. And, you know, I hate to say this, but Robbie Hummel made a point that is beyond debate, which is this has been an Achilles heel, not just this year. This has been a problem. And I don't know. It's look, fans oftentimes expect that teams should be able to work on and excel in every phase of the game. And the fact is, like most other things in life, that's not true. There are trade-offs. You only have a certain amount of time available to you, and you have to choose what you're going to spend it on. And Michigan State, I would think, is probably not spending a great deal of time on late game situations, but somehow this has to get addressed. The worst part of it is, if you look at drawing up a team that should be able to handle this, they're it. Now I realize they're not at full strength, but in a full strength situation, you've almost certainly got Jaden Akins out there. With it's probably Jaden Akins, Walker Hogard, Hall, and Hauser, right? That's a lineup where you should, in theory, be comfortable with any of those five guys handling the ball, passing the ball, shooting free throws, right? Yep. Any of them. And so this should not be a problem. Even with the current assortment, the current roster they've got, I'll take Pierre Brooks. Pierre Brooks has got a decent handle. He's a good shooter. You know, Mati Sissoko's not a handler, but certainly if they foul him, you know, he's shooting free throws well enough that you're probably okay with that. And yet we're seeing this. A team with this kind of strength in its backcourt should not go through this stuff, you know? And it's just a shame because it ruined what was going to be a very, very enjoyable podcast for us to do. Because up until that last, I was really impressed with the way Michigan State played in the second half of this one. Really impressed. I mean, I'll say this. We didn't have a lot to say about Portland because I just hadn't had a chance to see them. I had delved into the stats a little bit. But I think they did kind of live up in a way to most of what I expected. They shoot the ball very, very well. And you saw that. This is a good shooting team. More than that, I was impressed by the cleverness of what they run. They do a great job screening, staying moving, and getting themselves open for shots. I mean, that is a tough team to cover. And I think, you know, their Achilles heels, their problems are rebounding and the defensive end. But in the conference they play in, the WCC, it's often kind of defense optional. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's a longstanding criticism of Gonzaga is that they're not a much of a defensive program. I think St. Mary's often fits that mold. You know, the better teams in the WCC are not generally towers of strength defensively. So to me, I would think Portland has, they were picked fifth, which is middle of the pack. But based on what I saw and the other results they had from this weekend, I've got to think that they've got a chance to compete in that league. What that eventually means, who knows? But I was very impressed with them offensively. And yet Michigan State, I thought, really, really turned it up defensively in that second half. It was impressive to watch. And, you know, and offensively, they were pretty good most of the game. I mean, even with that late flurry of the three turnovers, MSU ended up with eight. So in the first 39 minutes of the game, essentially, five turnovers. That's fantastic. You know, that's exactly what you want. And you would say any game, Michigan State commits eight turnovers, wins the rebounding battle, shoots better than 50% from the floor and plus 40% from three. And you win by one. How is that even possible? But it was because we saw it.
Yeah. Well, let me go through some splits because, you know, I think in the one thing about these splits, the halftime splits, is it's not going to show the last minute because that, I think, is a different, like you said, it's almost like a third game. First half, Portland, the score is 42-34. They were dominating in the sense that they were 9 of 19 from 3. They were also, when they weren't hitting the threes, they were off those ball screens. They were just killing us going in and getting some easy plays of the hoop. They were out-rebounding Michigan State 18 to 17. They had 11 assists on those on their 16 field goals. They had only one turnover. Michigan State had 17 rebounds, so they were out-rebounded. 9 assists on 14 buckets. 3 turnovers for Michigan State, which, you know, pretty good. And Michigan State was 4 or 6 from 3. Just the volume was, you know, way less than what Portland was. The second half, again, outside of those that last minute, Michigan State was doing great. They shot 57% from the half to end the game at 52.5%. Shot 4 of 8 from 3. 18 rebounds to 8 for Portland. They had 8 assists to 6 for Portland. I mean, every facet of the game outside the last little bit, they were clearly the better team. And a lot of that was due to A.J. Hogarth, like you mentioned. He was much better in the second half until the very end of the meltdown. I don't know. I mean, I guess, well, let's talk about the shooting, because I think, you know, we expected Michigan State to be as good shooting as they were last year. Maybe not exactly, but I was super impressed. I know you've gone on about a couple times about how you expected a lot from Pierre Brooks, but he was really fantastic from outside tonight.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about him is, and he showed this really in the Oregon game where, what did he ended up 3 for 11 from 3. It really should have been 5 for 13, but, you know,
right, yeah.
If he'd shrink half a shoe size, it would have been, but still, the important part of that is he doesn't show any fear. He was willing to keep shooting. And I know he's a capable enough shooter that if he does that, it's kind of like the Tyson Walker effect from last year. If he takes shots, he's going to hit them, you know, and that sounds simple, but it's not so simple for everybody like Tyson Walker last year. But Pierre Brooks is confident, and that confidence is going to be a very important factor, I think, for Michigan State, because not only is he confident, he believes in himself, but he's got a quick release, so he's hard to guard out there. And he's got a knack for hunting shots, too, getting himself in spots. But, very impressive offensive game from him. You know, and as a team, the shooting, there's not much to complain about. You shoot 53% overall, 57% at the line, or 57% from three, rather. 8 for 14. The only complaint there maybe is that they didn't generate quite enough threes. 14's a little light, but remember we talked about in the pregame, for doing a quick analysis, I'm actually pretty happy with aspects of how this one worked. Because one of the things I talked about was this Portland team is really poor defending in the paint. And so Michigan State was 23 for 45 inside the arc. So they did attack inside the arc where I figured they were going to need to, and they produced in there. They got a lot done. Give Portland credit, I guess, for taking a lot of that away. I mean, they definitely were extending out on the arc and limiting Michigan State's looks, which again, going back to Pierre, made it so important that Michigan State had a guy who really doesn't feel like he even needs more than a sliver of space to get a shot up, because they didn't have a lot more than that. You know, the shots that Hauser and Walker hit, who were the other two guys that hit threes in this game, were much more of the wide open variety. For Pierre, it was at least a couple of his were under more duress, and that was kind of going to be what it would take in this game. So yeah, you're very happy with the shooting. You know, it positive there again, the turnovers. This is the other thing too. 8 turnovers as a team. Hogarth had 5. Hauser had 3. Everybody else, 0.
0. Yeah.
So, you know, is that good? It represents progress in a sense, but yeah, the timeliness when those turnovers happen, and the nature
and
of
what
them,
kind they are, right? The nature of them, exactly.
You just can't have it. So I keep beating the drum on that, but it's the lasting impression I have of this game. Now, all that said, I do want to give Michigan State one little bit of credit for what they did in the end game situation. The way they defended that last possession was pretty good.
Yeah.
Was it Robertson, I think, that got to the rim? And I'm trying to remember if it was just Mahdi or if it was a couple guys who challenged him and made that into a very, very tough finish. And of course, he couldn't finish it. Rebound kicked out, and kid was left making a desperation heave that didn't come close to hitting the rim. But they did do a decent job defending that last possession. You know, it makes a difference, I guess, if you can get set as opposed to scrambling after you've just thrown the ball to the other team. You know, funny how that works.
No question. Well, and I think, you know, another thing to look at is you look at rebounding. I don't think there's any questions. You know, this is the last time I'm going to say this. I don't think there's any questions of a much better rebounding team that we've had. And to your point, you've mentioned a number of times when you look at team rebounds and as a measure of effort and sort of,
it,
you know, going
be,
after
yeah.
the ball. Yeah. And I think, you know, you look at team rebounds, they had three and Michigan State had eight. And there was no question. There were a lot of times when, like, I know one of those was at Hogard. I don't know if it was the second half where it looked like they were going to get an offensive rebound. He kind of came behind and sort of stripped a little bit and it ended up off the Portland player's leg. And then, of course, Whitens, too, who was, I thought,
great. Yeah,
let's
talk about him.
I mean,
him.
He was, let's 17 minutes. And, yeah, well, let's talk about rebounding first, and then we'll talk about Whitens.
It's not all a function of effort, but sometimes it is on the glass. And I do not fault Michigan State's effort. And, again, this is, I don't want to keep making excuses, but this is with your two best perimeter rebounders, at least, not playing. And in a game where there are a lot of threes going up, that's you're going to get challenged there, right? A lot of long rebounds. And Michigan State held it down. I don't know what did Portland end up with in terms of offensive rebounds?
So their offensive rebounding percentage was 23%. Yeah. And Michigan State's was 36%.
And look, they're not a good rebounding team. So it should be like that. But we know that that doesn't always play out. You know,
and not last year.
Yeah. And so when you're limiting the opponent to one and done, that's a big deal. And I do think you're right that team rebounding stat in this game definitely was reflective, not so much of, you know, sometimes it could be that, oh, the other team just can't squeeze it. They keep losing what should be secure rebounds, right? Sometimes. But oftentimes it's the result of whichever team is competing a little harder and being a little tougher on contested rebounds. And that was Michigan State. I think Michigan State earned those tonight. So that was a positive.
No question. So let's talk about Jason Whitens, the guy who's forgotten by everybody. You know, he's not a scholarship player. And so there's always mentioned that there are only, you know, 9 or 10 scholarship players in the team, and one was going to be redshirted. And you know, Michigan State should retroactively go into the portal to get some guys. You know, Whitens, I think, showed that they've got a really good player who, you know, he's not going to light it up, although he did have that one jumper that he looked like he was trying to pass. Like, well, I guess I'll take this 10-footer or something. But his energy and his defense and his rebounding, just getting after the ball is, I don't know, it's impressive.
He should be in the rotation the rest of the way. And what that means from game to game, I think can and will vary, but he should be in the rotation the rest of the way. I've seen enough. You've seen hints of it in the first two games of this tournament where at the very least you saw him flying around. You saw the effort, right? I think tonight it was a more complete thing. The main reason he should play is his defense. He was getting used in both halves. I think one, because Michigan State, you know, third game in 4 days, they probably guys were a little gassed. And so Izzo felt like he needed to extend that bench just to keep guys fresh. But I also think what Jason Whitens has already proven, at least to my satisfaction, I would assume to Tom Izzo's, is that he can use him as one of Izzo's favorite tools. Whitens gives him access to one of his favorite tools, and that is a guy you can depend on to play the right way, do the things that Michigan State values in order to help teach and hold other guys accountable. So Pierre Brooks, you fall asleep at the switch too often on defense. Here comes Jason Whitens. You know, it's that kind of thing. And he's done enough, in my mind, at least, to demonstrate that he should be given that role. He should be given that opportunity. You mentioned, you know, two offensive rebounds. The one bucket was a fairly easy one. It was a lay-in. He just kind of found himself open around the rim. But the second one, remember, that was a bad inbound pass decision that he showed some athletic ability by going up and getting it. And then because of the contest, he found himself in a position where he had an open path to the middle of the lane, and he made the right decision. He didn't force anything. So many guys in his situation, not playing much up to this point, you know, hasn't really played much in 2 years, because remember, he was hurt all of last season. So many guys would freeze. Maybe they would back the ball out, or they'd try to force a pass to someone. Instead, he looked pretty under control. I don't know that he wanted to take that shot, but I think he understood that he should, and he hit it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the scoring aside, the biggest things are the defense and the energy. And when you can do those things, man, Tom Izzo is going to play you. Just history tells us this over and over again. And he's done it in the past by using walk-ons. You know, Mike Keebler from Okemos years ago was out. Tim Bogracos. You know, and those are – Bogracos is really very much a comparable guy to Whitens, because Bogracos could have been a scholarship player at a MAC or Horizon level. You know, Austin Thornton had high major offers. I believe he had an offer from Stanford that he passed on to go to Michigan State. And, you know, and he eventually became a scholarship player, but he's another example. I don't see any reason why we should think of Jason Whitens in any lesser way fundamentally than those guys. And all those guys I just named were players that contributed to very good Colby Wallenman at a different position, but still all those guys contributed to very, very good Michigan State basketball teams. So, you know, if you take that as being true, that, hey, Jason Whitens deserves to be in the rotation. Once you get Hall and Akins back, what are we talking about? 11 guys, right?
Yep.
Well, that looks like a pretty standard Tom Izzo team. Now, I don't know that, you know, I think situations are going to be important. You know, it might be that there's a game that Whitens doesn't play just because, you know, they're getting good defensive effort from everybody and it just doesn't lend itself to that. But man, he's already, you know, the other thing too, and this, why this would surprise anybody, I don't know, because we're talking about a guy that was a starter for 2 years at the MAC level. This is not a guy they just found at the IM, you know?
Yeah.
He looks comfortable out there. He doesn't look rattled. He doesn't look sped up. And I'm talking about both ends, you know, but even offensively, he looks comfortable to me. They're not asking him to go out and hit shots and make a ton of plays, but he looks all right. And if he's doing that, then he's not going to hurt you much at all, if at all, offensively. And you've got him out there primarily for the effort stuff that he gives you. So I'm very, very happy with him. That, you know, I think if there's a major silver lining to come out of this weekend, other than the fact that Michigan State did manage to win two games, I think it's that their young guys collectively, and I'll include Whitens as far from young, but I'll include him in that category. The three freshmen and Whitens all to me demonstrated, hey, relax. They're going to be fine. These are guys that can help you win basketball games. They're capable of hanging in there because they all had moments in this tournament. You know, today, this was not a great game for Jackson Kohler. Missed some very makeable shots. I don't know what was going on there, but, you know, but Carson Cooper stepped up. made a couple plays offensively. You know, they were dunks, but nevertheless got himself open. I thought the play he made on the inbound with Joey was that where he was the inbounder was actually a very savvy play. Great play. Just hang around, find space. And, you know, lots of good big men have made careers out of that. and he hung in there defensively. So Carson Cooper showed up. Trey Holloman didn't play much at all in the first half. And then they did turn to him down the stretch, made a big jumper, and did his usual thing on the defensive end. You know, I think they've got a particularly if I'm going to back up half a step. If AJ Hogard continues to play with, let's take the last minute and change aside. If he continues to have halves like he had in the first half, the most shocking thing in this game to me was that Tom Izzo kept him playing and didn't use Trey Holloman more to hold him accountable. And I say that I'm shocked because, you know, for all the people who over the years I've heard squawk about Izzo and said, oh, you got to let guys play through mistakes, which has never been Izzo's modus operandi ever. That's essentially what he did with AJ. And it was surprising to me because I thought there were plenty of opportunities where if it were me, I would have said, AJ, grab a seat. And I would have rolled with Trey Holloman because I know at least Trey Holloman's going to give me maximum effort. I know he's going to check people and I know he's going to make good decisions with the ball because I haven't seen him do anything but that this entire year when he's played. You know, he doesn't give you the same things as a scorer right now, but so what? You know, at some point you got to reach AJ. And I'm thinking that's a card that they haven't yet fully played. When Jaden Akins is back, which hopefully will be as soon as Wednesday, for those who were watching, note that he was not wearing a boot today. He didn't play, obviously. He didn't dress, but he wasn't wearing a boot, which to me is a sign that you're probably going to see him on Wednesday. I would assume so. When Jaden Akins is back, maybe it gets a lot easier to hold AJ accountable. But to me, Trey Holloman's done enough, too. I would play him. Mm-hmm. Give him an extra turn. Give him an extra 4 minutes and let's let AJ figure it out or not.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, when it comes to Izzo and dealing with players, you know, I don't know, you say coaches are like psychologists or whatever, you know, they're your parents kind of, you know, like your dad trying to figure out, they know how to motivate you or trying to figure things out. You know, there's a learning process when you have a player. How do you get this person to maximally perform? I mean, I know that's absolutely what he wants to do for everybody. And I think probably it's a learning curve for him too, to try and figure out what is it that he can do that's going to make AJ listen, right? I think that maybe it's not putting him in the bench for a little bit. Maybe he's trying to just yell at him when he's on the court. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I wonder if that's what he's just trying something different. I mean, it was a different situation because you're right. We're depleted. We don't have as many players. And so I don't know.
Maybe. But I just look at who Tom Izzo has been throughout his entire coaching history.
Right.
And the let them play through mistakes thing has not ever, ever, ever been in his vocabulary. It just is not the way he's ever approached it. And by the way, I think the track record tells you that that's probably a pretty good way to go. I don't know many programs, honestly, who don't approach it that way that are successful. You know, the ones that do, I think, you know, look at a team like Memphis last year, for example. You know, they end up being teams that are sloppy, unreliable. You can't count on them. There's no predictability. Mm-hmm. There's not much improvement, you know, all of that. And so I don't think Izzo's an outlier in that regard. I think he might be slightly less flexible than some other guys, but I think most all of the good ones do that. So it would be weird to me if he suddenly decided, especially his point guard. I mean, that's the thing. We're not just talking about any player. We're talking about the guy who's supposed to be the leader of your whole offense, right? That's what he's supposed to be. And the lack of focus, I won't say effort, I'll say lack of focus, and the mistakes, just, they're not excusable from anybody, but especially your point guard.
I think we'll talk. Let me just talk about a couple more stats that I think were that sort of illuminating for what happened. So points in the paint, Michigan State won 42-20. Not surprising. We mentioned that they really got in the
That this team, yep. Portland is just not a team that defends the two well, and they didn't. Michigan State took advantage.
And Michigan State had 8 turnovers. Portland had 15 points off those turnovers. So this is very much like the Oregon game. They don't have many turnovers, but they scored a lot of points.
Yep.
Michigan State had five turnovers.
Michigan State last minute, right?
Well, three. Yeah.
So it wasn't so bad before that.
Right. And fast break points, the last thing, Portland had 14, Michigan State had 4. That's the whatever you want to say about the fast break points. But I would say that I don't think Michigan State's break was not running well. I just don't think they had many opportunities because I think Portland was back all the time, which may contribute to the fact they were offensive boards were 20% or something.
Yeah. Portland was very definitely conscious of floor balance. And, again, I'll give these teams credit. We have yet to run into a game this season that we normally will have seen by this time where somebody just isn't prepared for what Michigan State does. And it especially is often the case in these holiday tournaments where somebody's just not prepared for it. And Michigan State is able to just blitz them. We haven't seen that. So Portland's a well-coached team. I mean, I'm impressed with Shontae Leggins. I really was. They do a lot of nice things offensively. They're together. They look like a connected team. I don't know how much better they can get defensively because I think there's some athletic limitations there that hurt them. But that said, they did a great job of at least preventing transition. And that will matter in their conference if they can continue to do that because we know Gonzaga likes to push the ball. There's some other teams in that league that will go up tempo if you let them. And if they could continue to at least do that much, they'll likely give themselves a chance.
Yeah. And our conversation would be entirely different had we played 58 minutes.
Right.
38 minutes. Yeah. 38 minutes. Right. Yeah. Those last two, it was a 12-point game. It was not, and Michigan State had definitely dominated the second half.
Yeah.
They out everything them. And then sort of the wheels fell off, but it was a dominant performance in the second half, which is what you expect and anticipate from a Power 5 school that, playing WCC.
Even so, even considering the 8-0 run in the last minute and 10, Michigan State still outscored them by 9 in the second half. So that even the collapse didn't change that. The Michigan State really won and controlled the second half for the most part. And that matters. That counts. And the thing was, they got right out of the chute. It was that there was obviously that segment where they scored 7 points, 5 of them from Mahdi, and I think Tyson got the other 2. I don't remember for sure, but 5 from Mahdi on a lob dunk, a foul, and the foul was then labeled a flagrant. And he stepped up and hit all 3 free throws, which was impressive, there was a lot to like if we're able to take a half step back about the things Michigan State did in the second half, just not the way I think you said it was like 3 games. So it was the first half, which offensively was okay. Defensively was not good at all. The second half where offensively and defensively, they were really good. And then there was the last minute and 10 seconds.
So if you had to guess right now, what would you guess at Mahdi Sissoko's free throw percentages for the season?
75?
70%. 69%. So he's 20 of 29 this season. So really impressive. I mean,
this is a guy who shot 42% last year. Not a ton of attempts.
Right. But 5-11 or something probably.
Yeah. Look, I don't think it's a fluke. Now, I'm not saying he's going to stay at 70. But if you told me before the season, hey, maybe Mahdi Sissoko ends up at 65%, 63% even, I would take that. Because a guy who's a big man who's plus 60%, you can probably afford to keep on the court in late game situations, which matters. It matters a lot because of what he gives you defensively and what he gives you as a rebounder. Now, he didn't have great rebounding stats in this game, but, you know, Mahdi is a guy who just by his presence, I think sometimes will make it easier for other guys to get rebounds because he will occupy opponent players and take up space. So I thought he played well again in the second half. He played far better. That's probably the best half of basketball he's played since Kentucky. I mean, statistically, it's easy to say that, but it was good stuff from him.
Yeah, and I'm just going to down this free throw thing. It is interesting because A.J. Hogard, 63% shooter last year. He's 83% this year.
Yeah, that's including, stunning. Is that including tonight?
Yeah, that's including tonight, 2 of 4. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say he didn't do himself any favors tonight. Yeah, and we've talked about it before, and he did do the job. You know, he hit two big ones down the stretch against Oregon. So he has hit pressure free throws in the very recent past. That's a big deal. And that's, again, it's just, I am so frustrated by this guy because he's your point guard. He's done exactly what you would want him to do. He's stepped up as a free throw shooter. So if teams want to try and foul him in late game situations, you should have a level of confidence that he can step up and hit them because he's been doing it. And as we've talked about here previously, it's not a fluke. His shot looks fluid, you know?
Yeah. It looks real.
Yeah,
for sure.
So God, he's got size and strength. Teams shouldn't be able to bully him with pressure as easily. And he should be able to see over traps more easily than say Tyson Walker, who he's got 4 inches on, you know, there's just no reason why. I hate to keep coming back to it, but it's so frustrating. And if it's frustrating for me talking about it, how must Tom Izzo feel? Because I sent out a tweet at the end of the game that I feel like AJ Hogard's very rapidly getting into the can't win with him, can't win without him category. And what I mean by that is he does so much and is so for you and is so important to your team that you have to have him out there, but yet he's also making mistakes that just kill you. So what a conundrum. I really don't. I don't have any bright ideas about how to handle it. He's just got to get better. His focus has to get better.
Right. I think it's between his ears right now, right? He's got to figure out who he is and how important he is to the team and to be that, you know, like you said, you've made a point many times before, good teammate, and know when to get his own and when not to, right? I think, and when not to be casual. He just to keep maintain that focus.
I just think about the great point guards. There have been so many of them at Michigan State. You know, you start with Cleaves and then, you know, Drew Neitzel, Kalen Lucas, Keith Appling. If you want to call Denzel Valentine a point guard, I'm not going to argue. Cassius Winston, certainly. These were guys that, and I'm not saying they never made mistakes, but it wasn't like this. You know, just as we're talking, I watch a replay of that turnover that's going to get attributed to Joey. That was absolutely AJ Hogard's fault. He did nothing to step to meet the pass. He should have gotten tagged with all three of those.
Is that the one at sort of midcourt, at half court, where Joey had to take it up on past the half court line?
No, that's another one too.
I felt like
he didn't come hard enough.
AJ
to
didn't
meet
make himself available.
Yes, there's a fourth one. I'm talking strictly about the real end game, but you're right. That's another one. So if you're looking at the film of this game, you could see a lot of things to like about what AJ Hogard did. But that stuff, that's got to go. That's got to go yesterday because, they're getting by and they're finding ways to win. And I guess credit them for that. You know, ultimately getting the W is the ultimate verdict. Right. But hey, this league, I watched Purdue absolutely spank Duke today after they did the same thing to Gonzaga 2 days earlier to win the other bracket, the PK Legacy bracket. Purdue looks very real to me, surprisingly so. I thought they'd be okay. they look much, much better than okay right now. I've talked about Illinois. We know people expect Indiana to be good. You know, Iowa had a pratfall the other day against TCU, but TCU is a good team. I think Iowa is going to be tough to deal with. Maryland has been a pleasant surprise. I've seen Ohio State play, and though they're young in some spots, I like their team. The Big Ten right now has been the most impressive of the major conferences. I don't think there's much debate about that.
Yeah.
And so that's what you're going into starting, you know, week after next with two games against Penn State and Northwestern. You're not going to be able, this stuff is going to bite them hard if they don't knock it off. You know, I mean, it's an obvious statement, but it's true. They can't do this. They have to find a way to get better at closing games out. And, you know, it would be one thing if we were sitting here and we've seen this before, and all programs do, where you look at it and you say, boy, all they had to do was hit their free throws and they just couldn't hit free throws. But this is worse. In my opinion, it's much worse. Because at least that you could say, hey, sometimes the shots just don't drop, you know, and that doesn't tend to be a thing that repeats as much. This is problematic because now you've just got multiple games where guys at winning time, where it's simple plays that need to be made, can't make them. And yet we can go back and we can look at the Kentucky game twice and see them execute as beautifully as you will ever see a basketball team execute a late game situation. So you tell me which is the real team, because I don't know.
Well, you know, it's sort of like, is, you know, it's almost easier sometimes when you're behind to execute than when you're ahead, you know, and maybe that's a little bit of it.
It could be that with a lead, they are too relaxed, that the focus level and AJ Hogard, coming back to him again, seems to be a guy who needs to have that focus locked in, whatever it takes, because if he lets it slip for a second, disaster happens, you know, and he's just, you said it, he's too casual. So that's got to change. That the whole thing's got to change. They've got to, and I don't pretend to have the remotest clue at an answer. I just know it can't continue, because if it does, they're going to start getting tagged with losses. And the shame of it is going to be, they're going to lose games that they have no business losing and where they actually earned a win by virtue of the way they played for, you know, 95% of it.
Well, you know, the next matchup is in South Bend on Wednesday at 9:15 and on November 30th. So we'll see. We'll hopefully get Jay Dinkins back then and can get a little bit back more to normal rotation. And, you know, the nice thing about it is we're still in November. And so there's every reason to expect that Hogard figures out whatever it is. He's got all, you know, he's got a good month to figure it out before the Big Ten gets hot and heavy. But to your point, it's not 3 months from now. He's got to figure it out pretty soon. Otherwise, it's going to look a little bit like last year where they're playing well and you're kind of like, these bad habits start kind of accumulating and they just never fix them as you're rolling into the Big Ten season, eventually caught up to them where they sort of just barely survived.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, that doesn't change that. You know, a typical Michigan State season is one where this evolves and improves and they get better. And that would most definitely improve or include improving this stuff we're talking about. But after a lot of downer talk from me, which listeners know is not my usual place, don't take that to mean I'm down on this team's long-term prospects. And you know, here's a thing to really maybe pay attention to. I'll reiterate what I said at the outset. They're 5-2 right now. And honestly, if I were picking that Notre Dame game, you know, I don't gamble. We don't tend to do predictions here. Michigan State ought to handle Notre Dame. I know it's in South Bend, Michigan. I've seen Notre Dame play. It's par for the course in recent years for Mike Bray team. They're unathletic. They don't have a ton of size. They frankly are awful defensively. Michigan State should win that game even on the road. And if you do, you're 6-2 through this period. And with one of those losses being a one pointer and the other one, okay, first game without two of your top six guys, the Alabama loss is what it is. I think you could feel pretty damn good. I mean, even if they were to lose to Notre Dame, I think you feel okay given the circumstances about where they are. But if they win it and they're 6-2, hey, there's not a lot to get upset about in the macro, right?
Right.
The micro, yeah, we know there are things that have got to improve. But if you get that one, and then you got two Big Ten games that, you know, it's never fun to go on the road, but if I've got to pick one arena to go in and play a road game, it's probably State College, Pennsylvania. Because
the catacomb?
Because nobody cares. And, you know, Penn State, they do something. Well, we got plenty of time to get into it, but yeah, that's a game. Look, if you're Michigan State and you want to think that you're for real in the Big Ten, you go and you win that game on the road. You know, that's a winnable one. And then you play Northwestern at home. Again, those are games you should win. You get through that. You get through these next three games. And if somehow they win them all and they're sitting at 7-2, then hopefully, assuming the recovery time for Malik Hall remains intact in terms of what they talked about, you probably don't have him for Brown, but who cares? But you will have him for after Christmas. I mean, even, you know, Christmas would be the 4-week mark. So what you hope is that they get him back before that. He's able to practice some, and then they've got him hopefully fully reacclimated by the time Big Ten play kicks back in. And by the way, yep, if you look at the schedule, even once it kicks back in, by Big Ten standards, it's a reasonably soft start. I know they've got Nebraska in there, I think is the first game after they come back in January. And then I want to say that maybe Minnesota, somebody else at the bottom end before they face Michigan in game 5 at Breslin.
Actually, Michigan is the second game. So,
oh, it is. Okay.
So to your point, going through the schedule, that the Oakland game is the 21st. So it's possible we see Malik Hall play a few spot minutes there, maybe kind of getting back, dusting off some of the rust. The 30th is Buffalo, and you'd expect everyone to be at full strength game. And then the 3rd is Nebraska at home, and then also then at home against Michigan on the 7th, and then they head to Madison on the 10th.
Yeah, I mean, kind of an
we play Minnesota.
An ideal,
yeah,
realistic, it would seem to me, and again, I'm talking out of my ass to an extent because we don't have access to Malik Hall's medical records. But if you take the assessment that we've been given by the program as gospel, more or less, a conservative way of looking at it would be Malik Hall plays in the Brown game, because that would be 5 weeks out from the injury.
The Buffalo game, the 30th, right?
The Buffalo, yeah, right. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Buffalo game on the 30th. That would be a very conservative way of looking at it. That's 2 extra weeks, you know? And that would be fine. Because then you've had them play a game before you go back into the Big Ten. You know, there'll be rust. I mean, it won't be perfect, but that's a very, very realistic scenario, it would seem to me. And that's the thing. If you're able to get through this period and keep winning games, wow. You know, I mean, it's better still, you know? So there's a lot to feel good about. It's just, you know, it's like they often say, you know, it's not always about the result. It's about the way you performed, and the way they performed doesn't necessarily leave you feeling great. But there were aspects of this game that were very impressive and that you can feel good about if you're a Michigan State fan.
No question. And you've played arguably one of the hardest schedules, non-conference schedules in America. And if you were to come out of that 6-2, I mean, you can't. For a team that wasn't even ranked to start this year, I mean,
and I don't want to hear, you know, people tell, oh, Gonzaga isn't as good as people thought, and Kentucky's not as good as people thought, and Villanova isn't as good as people thought, and Oregon's not as good as people thought. Okay, I'm not going to argue the fact that any of those teams have looked as good as perhaps people expected them to, but in some cases, there are very clear reasons for that. The latter two that I mentioned, absolutely, injuries are a big part of it. And the first two, I've got a feeling Gonzaga and Kentucky are probably going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when push comes to shove, I think they're probably going to have, we're going to look back in March and see if they had pretty good seasons. And that's all that ultimately counts if you're Michigan State. You just want the value of having played and in many cases beaten those opponents. And I think they're going to have that. I think Oregon and Villanova are still going to be tournament teams, in my opinion, assuming that they do get most, if not all, of their players back and healthy when they expect to. You know, so it's don't let anybody talk you into not being enthused about the bottom line as to what Michigan State's done against this schedule, because it's still impressive.
And so much better than had you played Elkhorn State and Akron.
Yeah. I'm going to point it, that's such a good point. Right now, you know, Indiana is enthused and they think they're pretty good. They're going out and they're waxing people. You know, the only real game they played Xavier on the road and they won by two. All right. That's a good win. A road win against anybody at that level is good. And Xavier's a pretty solid team. So they've played one game. Michigan State has played, what is it? Five, am I missing four, right? No, one, two, three, four, five high majors. Because I'm counting Gonzaga as high major.
They definitely are. Yeah.
Five. All of whom at the start of the season were expected to be tournament teams. And I would still bet that they all make it right now. I would still bet they all make it. We'll see if I'm right about that. And you're 3-2. You're 3-2 against that level of competition. That's strong stuff. You know, when people talk about the Big Ten surprising and being very impressive in the non-conference so far, Michigan State's a huge part of that. But make no mistake.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
So, there's a lot to be enthusiastic about. You got to take a little broader view and also make some assumptions about the ways in which Michigan State can and will get better.
Yeah, and I like, and from a sort of like a macro view of Michigan State, I like the fact the shooting seems to be as good as it was last year. The rebounding has improved. I mean, there's every reason to think that this is going to be a much better team than last year. So, you know, I think you can expect more things from this team, and I think they've shown it so far, even though they've been depleted this last two games or three games.
And one more point along those lines, which we're never going to know until we can look back and see what the end result was. Right. But, and I know I alluded to this earlier, something very important could have come out of this period, this weekend, and maybe even the next game or two. And that is that Michigan State is finding guys who can allow them to lengthen their bench. Yep. You know, Pierre Brooks, it's not all been, you know, seashells and balloons, as Al McGuire used to say. There have been defensive issues. There's been some focus and effort issues, but at the same time, has he proven to be a guy that you know can go out there and score for you? Absolutely, he has. Has he shown that he's capable, at least, of making defensive plays at times? Yeah, he's done that too. So he's given you reason for optimism, I think, that, hey, he can really be a guy you count on even when he's no longer starting, even when he's back in a reserve role. You know, we talked about all those three freshmen. They've all had moments just in the last 4 days. All three of them have had moments where you could look at it and say, I could see this guy coming. He's going to be part of something, and he's going to be better in February than he is now. And then you add Whitens to that mix. That's a positive thing. And they wouldn't have had the same opportunity to learn as much about those guys and get them the opportunities that they've had if you had your full complement of players. So, you know, looking at silver linings, that may end up being one, is that they found that their bench can be a little bit more than people thought.
Right. And the, not only did you learn all those things, but you also went 2-1. I mean, that's pretty great.
You won two games while you're at it. By the way, the other thing that should be mentioned here, we haven't even touched on it. Both at least nominally road games. I mean, Oregon. I don't know what did we talk about?
We did the fact that they were, I think that there were probably more Michigan State fans than Oregon fans. And I would just say in general, I'm shocked at how few fans there were at these holiday tournaments. I mean, I guess it's Portland and it's in the winter. It's not really a nice time to be there, but
it's surprising, really right? It's sad. And I mean, I've got Gonzaga and Xavier going on, and Gonzaga, especially, not that far away, right? Spokane. That's a respectable drive. It's empty. I mean, it's better than the two games Oregon was in. That's the thing. What I was going to say is, I watched a little bit of Oregon and Villanova today, and it was just as empty, if not more. So it was more empty than the Oregon Michigan State game, primarily because I would think Villanova didn't bring as many people as MSU did. But that is hard to understand. Now today was a little bit better because, they're in the home city for Portland, and I felt like it was a decent turnout, enough that, that had a feel of a road game, right?
A little bit. Yeah.
So give Michigan State credit for that, I guess. But it's one of these things. If you're not playing the two old reliables that I think just automatically without question have full gyms are Maui and Atlantis.
Yeah. Well, that Atlantis is tiny. And there can't be more than 1,000 people could fit in that place. It's like
so is Maui. Maui's essentially a high school gym. Right. That's part of it. But the other thing is obviously those are vacation destinations that in November it's easier to get fans excited about going to. But it's real. And I'd have to go back and look to try to remind myself. But I mentioned the other day that it felt to me like this PK event was way down in terms of the hype around it, the attention, all of that, as opposed to the first one 5 years ago. And I'm wondering if attendance is also down, because it feels that way to me, but I wouldn't trust my memory all that. But you look at the programs that are part of this thing.
Who's
Duke, North Carolina, Michigan State, Purdue. I mean, these are all not just historically great programs, but they're programs that have huge fan bases that travel, and then you're adding in, you've got all the Oregon, Portland State, Oregon State. So four in-state schools, theoretically, they should all be providing fans, but they really didn't in any meaningful way. It's just hard to understand.
I don't know. Maybe it's a reflection. Just people are, if you're going to attend a sporting event in November and do any sort of traveling, unless it's like super nice vacation spot, you're going to go to football. You're going to go to a football game. Oregon State football is this weekend. And I don't know.
Yeah, it has to be it, but it's really unfortunate because the basketball, I'm not saying that the level of play has always been brilliant, because over a 4-day event, it usually isn't with that many games. But there's been a lot of exciting basketball. Today we had North Carolina and Alabama go four overtimes, I think. At least three. That's insane. And there's so many really competitive games and games that were actually well played too. And to not have full-throated, really impressive turnouts is disappointing. But what can you do? I always have to remember that college basketball is a niche sport, as much as I wish it weren't, for 90% of the season. And then the 10% of the season, it has everyone's attention.
Right. Yeah.
So
it's almost like you shouldn't mess with that part of that 10%.
Yeah, right.
You should be very careful with that.
Right. Well, we'll see.
So I guess that brings a close to the Feast Week, which I think you mentioned at the beginning of this, it was about a 10 or 11 day Much like my wife's birthday gets stretched out for a week or a month sometimes. And so it just kind of kept going and going. So Michigan State comes through relatively unscathed, 2-1 despite the injuries. And they're going to be up next, like I mentioned earlier, Notre Dame. We'll have a show in a couple of days with a preview for the Notre Dame game. I'd encourage you to subscribe in your podcast player and to not forget that on December 7th, that's the week after the Notre Dame game, after the Penn State game, we'll be having on retired assistant coach Mike Garland, who will be coming to do a post-game analysis with us, which we're very excited about. So make sure you don't miss that broadcast at all. So until next time, the Final Four is on the schedule. Go Green.